UK Wine Show, show number 210. Merit Wines with Mike Roberts from Ridgeview. Good morning, afternoon or evening, whichever is the most suitable for you out in Podland. Welcome to this week's UK Wine Show for the 4th of June. And as we celebrate English Wine Week, we're looking at the history of sparkling wines and why champagne really is an English drink that the French copied. How's that for something controversial? Has it got your attention? Well, we're going to be talking with Mike Roberts from Ridgeview. In my opinion, the UK's top sparkling winemaker. And we're going to be talking to him about the history of sparkling wine, a movement to make merit the name for English sparkling wine. And also, can you name the grapes in Champagne? If you said Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier, well, you'd be half right. Stay tuned for the rest of the varieties that are allowed. But first up, we have our mystery wine region. As usual, I'm going to give you two sets of clues. One set of clues now, and the second clue just before the interview. And as usual, we're going to give you the answer at the end of the show. And our first clue in our mystery wine region is it's in the northeast of Spain and has been in the shadow of its neighbouring Rioja until quite recently. However, recent investment by regional governments to establish a research centre in Olite has encouraged experimentation. Now it's producing some of the most interesting wines coming out of Spain. Viura is the main white grape, along with Grenache Blanca, Malvasia, and Moscato Grand Menduro, which I've never come across before, as well as Chardonnay. However, only 5% of the wine is white. Rosado, which is pink wine, although still 25%, is losing out to red wines. Have we think about that? But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thank you, Chris. The short selling of Chateau Lafite 2009, which has not yet been released by the Chateau, has divided opinions amongst the wine trade. Fine wine traders Livex offered the latest vintage of Lafite for £11,750 a case, but the actual sale went through for £10,000. Wine merchants like Sam Gleave of Bordeaux Index and Oliver East of Far Vintners condemn the selling of a wine that's not yet offered by the Chateau as reckless and irresponsible because it encourages the Chateau to increase their prices. But others, including Berry Brothers wine director Simon Staples, concede that the move was inevitable, although disappointing. Livex says on its blog that this sort of trading would not raise an eyebrow outside the wine trade and is vital for price discovery in most markets.
Short selling is the sale of something without owning it. So someone's selling Lafite without actually owning any Lafite. The idea is that they will hopefully buy the wine cheaper in the future than they're selling for it and therefore make a profit. While it is part of the price discovery process, all it really says is that one person thinks the price will be higher, the buyer, while another person thinks the price will be lower, the seller. If big volumes sell, then it can be part of the price discovery process. But a case is not part of a price discovery. Even 100 cases isn't really enough. But ultimately, short selling is usually based around commodities, financial products, or shares. Fundamentally, the Bordeaux market is not a true market, as there is ultimately one seller of Lafite, and that is Lafite. As such, the market is heavily distorted, so the idea that short selling could be part of the price discovery process is a very weak price signal. To me, it sounds like a bunch of traders transferring financial instruments from the stock market to the wine market, which I'm not necessarily opposed to, but in a previous life, I used to trade energy in New Zealand, and we had about four or five players selling energy, and what happened there was a huge distortion in the market. There just simply wasn't enough people selling the product, and I don't believe that with Lafite being the only true supplier of Lafite, whether one person will not create a massive distortion in the market. The final thing to consider is that whoever buys this wine is buying from someone who has no necessary ability to actually get the wine in the first place. As a result, the person buying the wine is taking on quite a large credit risk with the person selling the short. And we've seen a lot of Bordeaux sailors go down, even when they had the rights to En Premier, simply because they went bust. So there's no real guarantee that this person who sold the wine short selling is going to be able to come through with it. I don't have a lot of confidence in this sort of short selling. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, what's claimed to be the second biggest wine auction of all time took place in Hong Kong this week on the 30th of May 2010. Acker, Merrill & Condit's auction of the Imperial Cellar realised an amazing 152 million Hong Kong dollars. That's close to 19.5 million US dollars. The Imperial Cellar was owned by entrepreneur Eric Greenberg and contained over 19,000 bottles of wine amounting to 1,820 lots, of which 97.3% were sold. Over 400 of Asia's most serious wine collectors gathered to participate in the bidding, and they were joined via the internet and phone from absentee bidders from all around the world. New world records were set for the sale of Chateau Margaux, DRC Monrachet and Henry Jaeger, which realised a staggering 1.95 million Hong Kong dollars. The auction once again illustrated the keen demand for fine wines from buyers in Asia and particularly in China. But the sale digs up some controversy surrounding Eric Greenberg, who's known as the man with the golden cellar. In 2007, a federal lawsuit was filed against Greenberg regarding some wines sold through Zaki's to millionaire wine collector William Koch. The question mark was over 11 bottles that Koch had bought. Sotheby's had originally been approached to carry out the earlier auction, but they had rejected the offer, stating they would only be happy to sell a portion of Greenberg's wine, and that highlighted some concerns over authenticity.
As Jane said, Sotheby's had already rejected Eric Greenberg's wines over concerns about authenticity. But as we know from our trip to Hong Kong, there's no forged wine in China. Yeah, right. In actual fact, Acre has this week had a small victory. They were being taken to court for selling the fake wines by Bill Koch, the billionaire, who bought some of the Thomas Jefferson wines and found out later they were fake. According to the court, a reasonable consumer, alerted by a disclaimer contained in Acre's auction catalogue, including the prospective bidders must satisfy them by inspection, and would not have been misled by Acre's catalogue description. In other words, whatever Acre writes about the wines, they've got a disclaimer to protect them. Given the quality of some of the fakes produced by German Harvey Rodenstock, the only way that can be checked is through destructive testing. That is, to open the wine up and either do carbon dating or radioactive dating. It's unlikely that any of the buyers of Eric Greenberg's cellars can do so. And as a result, there's no way of being sure that they are buying the genuine article. And whatever Acre write about the white, it's not important as they have a disclaimer in small print saying, ignore what we say. Let's face it, after all the health scares from Chinese manufacturers and fake goods streaming out of China, as well as many wine buyers that use wine as a gift rather than as something they actually consume or collect themselves, fakes in Eric Greenberg's cellars aren't really an issue. They'll be sold and they'll continue their journey as fakes. The fact that Sotheby's wouldn't touch the cellar is a clear sign that there are significant concerns about these wines. And the fact that Eric had to go to Hong Kong to sell the wines is even more concerning. Now, I know Acre considers this a huge achievement about having the second highest wine auction, but I think they should be more worried and something they shouldn't be crowing about. Once again, if you don't know a heck of a lot about what's going on about all these fake wines, get The Billionaire's Vinegar. It's an excellent book and gives you a background on a lot of what's going on here. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, research by the University of Auckland's Wine Science Programme has found that cold storage of Sauvignon Blanc can triple its shelf life and reduce the loss of fruit aromas over time. The study showed that temperature is more important than oxidation in retaining fruity characteristics during storage, and that well-managed refrigeration could help to improve the consistency of quality wines and help producers, exporters, retailers and consumers to manage their wines better. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website, 3050.co.uk.
This has got to be one of those duh moments when someone says something so basic and they're getting paid to say something so basic. Now, I'm not a great chemist, but I remember back in high school doing basic chemistry that reactions in solutions that have more energy, i.e. that are hotter, will occur faster. Now, it's not surprising then that someone's taken this principle that I learnt playing with Bunsen burners in the sixth form and have said that wines chilled down will react slower and age slower. But it does raise some interesting questions for me. If you remember, I'd been complaining about New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc 2008 being very reductive, well, some of them anyway. Well, thankfully, we've finally cleared out all the 08s from my suppliers in the UK, which is about 6 months after they should have been finished selling through. It's now, what are we? It's now June. We normally change over to the new vintage around September, so it's almost 6 months later. In fact, it's been over 6 months later, which is quite a concern, particularly when you consider that the 2009, which was just as big a vintage as the 2008, better quality, but just as big, means that we're probably not going to stop selling that until 2012. So it's quite important to learn how to keep these New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs in good condition. But getting back to those reductive wines, one of the things about the Spy Valley wines that I came across that were very reductive, some shipments that came to me were fine, and some shipments the next week or month later were really reductive. And then I'd go back to another fine shipment, and I was getting quite confused. And I couldn't work it out because it was bottle variation. Bottle variation doesn't happen with screw caps, or it shouldn't happen with screw caps. So what was going on? In the end, I decided that maybe it was different batches. You know, they've got different tanks with slightly different mixes of wine from different regions, processed slightly differently. And if you recall back in show 204, we talked with Tim Heath and Siobhan Harnett about reduction in wine and nitrogen levels in the soils. So I'd sort of decided that maybe some of the batches had lower nitrogen levels in them than others, and hence were more reductive. But it could be that some of the wines came over to the UK on container ships, were on the outside of the ship and actually got quite hot when they were passing through the equator, speeding up their aging process, and perhaps meaning that some of the wines were slightly more reductive. Quite interesting, quite confusing. What I'm going to do next, though, is in this week's spotlight, we're actually going to look at wine storage conditions. I think we've talked about it enough to really get in there and have a nice wee spotlight on wine storage conditions. Many people talk about the ideal conditions for wine storage, but there's a more important question that is really addressed when we're talking about wine storage, and that is, why would you want to store wine? The answer has a number of different possibilities, but it also results in a number of different ways of storing wine. So, for example, you might have bought a case of 12 bottles and you don't feel like drinking 12 bottles in a row, bang, 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 but want to drink them over a period of maybe 6 months. So you might want to store the wine to drink at a more leisurely time. It could also be that maybe the wine's poorly made, or perhaps it's got too many tannins or acidity for you, and by letting the wine age, they'll soften out and the wine will become more palatable for you. Or you may be hoping that the wine develops some unusual flavours, and as the acidity and tannins soften, it starts developing some unusual flavours in the wine. Some people quite like that. Or finally, it could be that you're looking to hold the wine as an investment and simply just sell the wine on in the future for a profit, so you're not actually going to intend to drink the wine. Depending on the goal, you can change the way the wines evolve to suit your needs. So it's quite important to take these into consideration when you're storing wine. One shoe doesn't always fit. In the first part, we're going to look at how wines age, and not next week because we're doing the poll, but the week after that, we're going to look at the appropriate storage conditions for these wines. So the first thing to note is, as wines age, there are many things going on. On the surface, the flavours change, but so does the acidity, tannins, and even colour of the wine. So let's have a look at some of these components as they change. The first one is those drying, rather astringent tannins. They're part of a group called polyphenols, which include molecules responsible for colour of the wine. These are known as anthocyanidins. Over time, the tannins and those colour molecules tend to clump together, forming chains. This is known as polymerization. A lot of technical words in here, but those chains get bigger, and as they get bigger, the tannins with their harsh bitterness soften out, so the wine gets softer as those chains get bigger, and also the colour binds up and starts to come out of the wine. Eventually, those molecules that have got the tannins and the colour in them get so big that they actually come out of the wine, form part of the sediment you see in an old bottle of wine. So the wine's tannins and colour will change. And from a colour point of view, what tends to happen is the blue colour comes out of the wine. So when wines are quite young, they're quite vivid, purpley colour. And as the blue comes out, they go to a more reddy colour. Eventually, they go to a bricky brown mahogany colour as the blue comes out of the wine. Another thing that happens is acidity changes as a wine ages. Now, the acidity combines with alcohols to create flavours known as esters. And these new esters hide the unchanging acidity. So acidity actually doesn't change as a wine ages. What happens is esters and flavours hide the acidity, making the impression that acidity is actually softening as a wine ages. Eventually, these new secondary flavors and their associated esters are going to fade from the wine, along with the primary fruit flavors. So the acidity will no longer be hidden, and the perception of acidity will return to very old bottles of wine. Flavors are also decreasing as the wine ages, so the wine's going to lose some of those initial fruity flavors. It'll develop some secondary flavors, these savory, estery type characteristics, and eventually they'll fade as well, and you're left with the wine. The good time to drink a wine is when the tannins and acids are in balance, but before all that fruity flavor is gone. You want to have some fruitiness and maybe some secondary aromas, these flavors, these unusual flavors, if you can get them. If you wait too long, the fruit flavors that are hiding the unchanging acidity and also the unchanging alcohol will vanish. And what you're left with is a wine where the alcohol seems too high and it's hot, and the wine's too acidic with no real flavor. So it'll be a hollow, hot wine, not enjoyable. So that's sort of what happens to a wine when it ages. And we're going to talk about the storage conditions associated with different types of aging, not next week, but the week after next. But next up for the interview, we've got our mystery, a wine region. And the clue is that this region's soils, for most part, are loam over gravel with some lime and chalkstone bedrocks, are excellent for vines. The climate becomes drier towards the south, with more northern and higher areas at altitudes of about 460 metres having microclimates that benefit from cooler, wetter weather on the north side of the mountains. The combination of good soils and microclimates enables growers to plant a wide variety of grapes, though red grape varieties are favoured with about 70% of the production. Grenache is the most planted, followed by Tempranillo. Other recommended grape varieties include Grassinio, Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon. Have we think about what that mystery region is? It's a northern Spain region near Rioja, not Rioja. Have we think about that? And I'm going to give you the answer after the interview, which is coming up next. Now, this week, we're going to be interviewing Mike Roberts from Ridgeview. Mike is one of my favorite English producers, but we're going to be talking to Mike a wee bit about grape varieties and sparkling wines, but the particular focus on merit as a possible name for English wines. Let's have a listen to what Mike has to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Mike Roberts, owner and winemaker of Ridgeview and also the UK Vintners Association Winemaker of the Year. How are you, Mike?
I'm fine, thank you very much. And just to put the thing in perspective, I think I would now say my son is doing more of the winemaking than me. Maybe I'm doing some of the directing still, but he's really the winemaker at Ridgeview now.
It's quite a family operation down there, isn't it? You've got your daughter working there and your son now?
Yeah, well, obviously my wife as well. So there's my wife, my son and daughter, and my son's wife, Marty, who's Australian, and came to England with Simon in 1999, I think.
Very nice. We're not going to be talking about happy families today, though. We're talking about merit, or partly Christopher Merit, really. But you own the licensee or the brand name for Merit and wines. Why did you try and license
that? Well, it was... I must give credit. In fact, the credit is somewhat split between Hugh Johnson and Tom Stevenson. But Tom Stevenson and I were talking one afternoon about creating a generic name for English sparkling wine. And he actually asked me the question, did I think there was it would be a good idea to have a single generic name for English sparkling wine? And I said, I think there's merit in that. And he said, well, it's strange you should say that, because there is this story. And he recounted the story how 30 years before Dom Pérignon even went to Hautevillers in Epernay, there was a paper presented to the Royal Society, and we're looking forward to the 350th anniversary of that, because this was in 1662. So it's not just the Olympics year, 2012 is an important year. But he presented this paper, which described what has now truly become the method traditionnel, the traditional method, or what used to be called by everybody the Champagne method, but obviously now only called by the Champenois. And it is the process of deliberately adding sugar to a finished wine and then encasing it so that another fermentation takes place in which the carbon dioxide is trapped into the wine. And he describes how in London, where the paper was presented, he was now making it. He was importing base wines and then adding molasses to it. I mean, unfiltered wines will do it naturally, so yep. He wasn't adding yeast. And then he would, because he had access and was making very strong glass, because he was using coal, not charcoal. Mm-hmm. And he had access to cork. So unlike the Champenois, who are using flimsy material for casking their wine, and then putting wood and rags into the top to protect it, we were using cork because of our association with Portugal. And he was able to tie that cork on. And then he describes how in London they were drinking this lovely spirituous effervescent wine. So it's got, to me, it's got strong London connections,
yep.
The sparkling wine process. And of course, Merit is a very, it's a wonderful name to be able to use on our wines to associate it with this invention.
Just on that, he didn't get rid of the dead yeast, though. I presume there's a bit of
probably
dead
not, yeast. But in fact, in Champagne, they didn't until the Veuve Clicquot, the widow Clicquot, decided to drill holes in her desk. She had a carpenter do that, and she turned the bottles upside down. And then they were able to expunge the yeast, basically, out of it. Because, in fact, you know, if you do open a bottle of undisgorged wine, if you open it, it's, if you put it upright, all the yeast does settle to the bottom of the pump there. And if you pour it reasonably quickly, and you will get it to pour out reasonably clear. But, I mean, clarity was not in the 1600s. Clarity was not the most important aspect of wine.
No.
Anyway, and they didn't dosage it either. So it was you know, really Brut Zero, as the first editions of Brut Zero, probably. But Tom Stevenson and I said, well, it'd be a great idea to be able to create a circle where we could have Merit as a special quality edition, where it was tasted, it was vetted, and it was approved. And unfortunately, the bureaucracy that goes on around wine and the size of the industry back in the, 1995 or thereabouts meant that the idea of actually spending money on trademarking and things like protecting the name, it was a difficult decision for the national body. And I said, well, I think it's important. So I went and did it. And it cost a lot of money in the end because it's, it is protected in many countries now.
Mm-hmm.
And the
it's about Merret, isn't it?
Yeah, there will be a debate because spellings were never formalized back in 1600. So sometimes you would see it with a double T, but majority of times it's accepted that it's with one T.
Mm-hmm.
We registered we started with a registration in the UK, and that was going through a process because there was a debate: was it too similar to Merit, as opposed to being describing a trademarking a virtue, which is not really trademarkable. But we got through that eventually. But we also put into a European one, and our European one was actually rejected to start with because there was already an application in from a Portuguese company who had recognised the virtue of this name and wanted it for sparkling wine. And but fortunately, our registration in the UK, our application in the UK, predated theirs by 7 days.
Oh, really? That's quite
and,
close.
So they had to get out of the operation because being inside the European Union, ours took place to theirs, which was very fortunate. And it shows you that, in fact, we've been approached in the, several years ago now by a consultant for a group of sparkling, New World sparkling winemakers, I presume, who approached me to see whether we would allow them to use the name as well. And I said, well, if we widen it ourselves, we own the trademark, and if we want to widen it, then the thing it's got to be widened to is English wine, not everybody's sparkling wine. It's too valuable and it's too close association to have it just as another mark to counter champagne. Now, we've been using it since we registered, and our very first wines that came out in 99 had the Cuvée Merit on it. We've tended to drop the Cuvée part of it, generally speaking, not totally, because we've anglicized more and more of what we've done. Because we have to remember, back in the latter half of the 90s, the word English was actually a negative marketing word. Today, really, because of the success of sparkling wine, the still wine is enjoying a great renaissance as well because of the word English is now, like Australia, it's a good brand.
Yep.
but one of the problems we face, and I think this is something that's been repeated with several of the original sparkling winemakers, let's put it that way, is that the concern that the new wine legislation says that pretty well everybody can call their wine English, because the European Union have recognised that England is not really a country. You're supposed to put a member state, which is why it used to be called UK table wine or UK something wine.
Yep.
But they registered that England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales were to be treated as, for this purpose, as if it was a country. So now, as a special dispensation from Europe, every wine we make can have the word, in fact, has to have the word English or from England on it, because it's the provenance of the wine. But that does mean, and the other thing is that you have to describe what the product is, and one of the products is sparkling wine. Another product is quality sparkling wine. And the difference between those two is just simply fundamentally, it's the aging of the wine. So pretty well everything that's made in the UK goes into the category quality sparkling
wine. How long does it have to be aged to be called quality sparkling
wine? 9 months.
9 months, so pretty short time for any autolysis.
Well, I mean, yes, but you have to bear in mind that most of Champagne is only 12 months. It's 15 months legally, but of course it's 15 months on the lease. It's not. It's 12 months on the lease and 3 months and, post-disgorgement. That's all that's required. It's got to be in the bottle. And the majority of English sparkling wines are well over the 9 months, yes. But quality sparkling wine. So every single wine that's made, no matter what it's made from, could be called English quality sparkling wine. So in reality, someone looking at the fundamental part of a label that you're looking at, a consumer doesn't really differentiate between one and the other, whether it's made from classic champagne varieties or whether it's made from what might be called the old band of English grape varieties, the German varieties.
Like Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, Sauvignon Blanc in particular.
But there's some nice Sauvignon Blanc sparkling wines out there.
There are, but they're different. They're very different, and they're not to be considered to be the same. There are several of us who, the people that have been around for a bit, saying, well, we've very much put our effort into creating brand of English sparkling wine, and there are many, many more people coming onto it now where we have no real quality control or management of it. So the idea is formulating, and to some extent, it needs to be driven by the press and the populace as well to say to me, would you share your merit license? It's rather like asking Merton Shandong to say, would you share your Dom Perignon with somebody, the brand? Well, they probably wouldn't, would they? Because it's such a strong brand in its own right. But to me, I still, not being totally altruistic about it, I think I would like to see the very, very best English sparkling wine have that accreditation called merit. And in order to do that, we would set a whole series of hurdles, frankly, for people. Because it's not just the wine, it's got to be the winery itself, the record keeping, the processing and the methods used and how it's pressed and how it's treated. All of these things need to be cached. Pretty well a set of rules which won't be look very dissimilar from CIVC rules, champagne.
Yep, the champagne rules. Would you specify the grape varieties as being?
Absolutely, yes, I'm afraid we would. I wouldn't want to give merit away to anything other than the champagne varieties. I might well, in a limited way, I'm not totally sure. Now, let's say the three champagne varieties that we know, because, of course, there are five other champagne varieties in Champagne.
And which are they?
Arban, Petit Meslier, Gamay, Pinot Gris and Pinot Blanc, but with champagne names on the Pinot Gris and Pinot Blanc. But they are no longer allowed to be planted unless
that's right.
You have goes back to
vine.
The replacing the vines that you have. And I have to say that my son and I, son Simon, went to Champagne because we were considering planting a small patch of Arban. And for saying, well, this is an old Champagne variety and it's interesting. And we thought it would be very interesting to do so. And a lovely company called Moutarde down in the deepest south of Champagne, down the Aube. It makes a million bottles, so it's not all, but a small proportion is made into a single vintage Arban, and then something called the Cépage, where they use some of the three that we know, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Meunier, but they also use into that Petit Meslier Arban and one of the others, I'm not sure which one. And they make it into six, a Cépage. And We were going to see him because he's one of the few places where you might be able to buy a few vines, but it literally maybe 25. It's not, you know, you can't buy. If you want to go and plant 500, they look at you. You know, you'd have to plan that 3 years ahead or something like that.
Yeah,
to someone special. anyway, we actually were going there. We stayed in our usual hotel that we go to, which is a two-star loggie just outside of Epernay in Mousy, where they have a wonderful wine, a champagne list. It's very inexpensive. It's the Champagne Auberge. It's a wonderful place to visit because it's got lots of the old history of Champagne, including lots of the old displays of all the old ways of doing it and so on.
Yep.
It's very interesting. I recommend it to people to go there, and it's very, very inexpensive. And anyway, on the list was this bottle of Arbin. And we said, well, let's try it. And we sat there and we had our meal drinking this. And we both looked at each other when we got to the end of the bottle. And we said, I think I know why they chose the other three varieties. it is a very strange flavour, I have to say.
Really? Can you describe it?
Almost no, I don't think I can actually. It's earthy. It's so earthiness would you normally associate with sort of the Pinots and things, wouldn't you? But it's got a strange musky. And it wasn't a cork. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with the wine. You could tell that. Anyway, so we've tracked. So we would only use this moment in time. I really would not permit the idea. But of using anything other than Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier in merit wine.
Okay. In terms of working with other producers, have you said there was other producers who were interested in using the
people label. Have expressed an interest, and we are in a way trying to think how we might do it, because one of the issues are that, in fact, you know, there are a couple of names, and I'm not going to talk about who they are, but they're probably fairly obvious, but you know, who say, well, we created brand, so we have the brand anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Ridgeview brand, and the brand is well known, and within that we've got sub-brands of Bloomsbury and so on. There is a reluctance to say, well, we don't want to give it away either. And if the brand is strong, why worry that everybody's going to call their wine English Sparkling Wine? But I think the industry is going to get so much bigger and so much, potentially so worldwide, so impressive, that it does need something a bit more direct, catchy, obvious.
Yeah.
A single word type of thing like champagne, where it says merit, and you do go in, and you would go into a restaurant and say, have you got any merit? Which one have you got? And you don't choose, just as you would with champagne. Which champagne do you carry? And
yep.
We would probably, I think, in a few years' time, expect virtually every restaurant, every restaurant today has some champagne by 2015. Pretty well every restaurant will have a bottle of English sparkling wine to choose as one of their sparkling wine choices. But it'd be lovely then to be able to think of people talking about merit. There's a long way to go though to do this, because of the issue is really saying, well, we want to really protect the status of the top winemakers in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
They've created a brand. They've in fact, in a way, created the English brand. You know, if you want to put it that way, that's being very big-headed, and I shouldn't say things like that. But you know, in a way, they have. It's the fact that Knightimber and Ridgeview have won the best sparkling wine in the world, and so three times in the last 8 years, 9 years, something like that, it's been won by English wine. And so it's been elevated, the whole wine sector's been elevated. Just passing that off and saying, well, if merit makes them equal to those, the other people, that the new people coming into the merit name would have suddenly got all of the credit that's taken some of us, 10 years to build up.
Sure.
And so it's a question really.
I suppose it's how you license it though, isn't it?
So the licensing would have to include things, I think, this is the way we're thinking. But again, we want people to really want to take it on board. And one of the parts of it's got to be that, in fact, people have got to be prepared to put marketing money into it. So I think, if we were doing, if I painted an ideal picture, we would get people to use the word merit. But, in doing so, there would be a license fee per bottle, of which at least 75% would have to be spent by the licensing body, directly on the marketing of merit.
Would you still own the brand? Because it would be harder for other people. It would be better to move it into, say, a trust or a...
That's the sort of thing that's being discussed. I mean, it would be who would own it and would it be a multiple? But the problem is, again, you know, this is where you get all of these issues coming up. But the problem with total trusts is that, in fact, you get back into the difficulty of running a trust is that it becomes a committee. No choices are made and you can't get a direction, you can't get a clear direction. But something like, part of the CIVC program that sets the price of grapes, you know, is where it's a nominated set of seven producers and seven growers. It could be a nominated set of people, producers, that, you know, have seats on that council,
mm-hmm.
you know, with certain voting positions. Because merit, if it has any credibility, will have been created, come out as a top because of the success of two or three significant players in the market. So it's a grandiose idea, but it's also one that, in a way, Ritchie doesn't have to do anything in some respects. We actually have the merit name.
Yep.
We have the Ritchie name, so we have two good brandings in what we're doing. And we can elevate, and you see our new labelling now, there's much more emphasis into the Ridgeviewing brand rather than the subsidiary brands like Bloomsbury and so on. So we're trying to make sure that everyone really starts talking just Ridgeview rather than some people used to actually come to us and say, well, I know Bloomsbury, and they didn't know that we make Bloomsbury for a terrible situation for us in a marketing sense. So we built a brand up and we've been associated with it. We want to control the brand, and we don't have to give it away. When it's given away, we expect to be part of the monitoring body and so on. Mm. The brand is valuable. So I've got to say, I've got to be careful that I'm not giving something that is of just
a viable value. It is very altruistic of you to do that, though.
It would be altruistic even if I gave it away for some money, even if you know what I mean, because it is a very valuable brand. But it becomes much more valuable in a way... What I really want, it sounds silly, but in some respects, I really would rather there become a momentum of people saying that it really would be good if you could do this and come out with something. In other words, that it's in a way saying, instead of me saying, I think we should be trying to drive this forward, get other people to come and say, would you, and how mm-hmm. would you do it and set it up so that we can create something, recognizing what the prime players, the historic players in the sparkling wine have put into the industry to make it where it is today.
Excellent. All right, Mike, we'll wrap it up there. I'll let you get back to the
trade testing. Thank you very much. Go and see some customers.
Cheers.
Hope you enjoyed that interview with Mike. Some interesting stuff, particularly about those unusual grape varieties that are allowed in Champagne. Not many people talk about them, but they only talk about the three main ones, but interesting. How do you feel about merit as a name for English sparkling wines? I think it's a great name, but worried that Mike wants to keep complete control over it. I know he talks about giving it up to a trust or something, but he wants to hold on to it, which is good, but not open. And that may hamper the uptake of the name. Next week, we're going to be looking at grape DNA. If you recall, a long, long time ago, there was some work done on working out the parents of Chardonnay, the male and female parents. Well, I popped up to Cambridge to interview Chris Howe, the professor behind all that, and we're going to be finding out all about grape DNA. Bit of a science geeky one for you guys who like that. I hope you're going to enjoy it. And before we finish up, we've just got one last thing, and it's our mystery region. And it was, of course, Navarra in Spain, just right beside Rioja. Getting some decent wines out, but I've had a few reasonable Navarran wines over the years. Anyway, that last thing is our quote. Forgot to mention our quote, didn't I? And last week we were talking about what Baron Philip de Rothschild said about Mouton Rothschild before he was upgraded to first growth. This is what he said afterwards. First I am, second I was. Mouton does not change. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.